Thank you for downloading this program from the BBC. This program is part of World War One on the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/ww1.
I'm Dan Snow. Welcome to Voices of the First World War. In the years leading up to the centenary of the war, the last of those who actually experienced it have passed away. But the Imperial War Museums and the BBC had recorded interviews with many veterans to try to capture what it was like to actually be there. This series listens to those stories.
And he had almost tears in his eyes. He says, you don't know what you're up against. And he really was genuinely concerned at the trouble that we were going to meet.
It's funny how one doesn't realise one's being indoctrinated, but of course, the whole atmosphere then was much worse than in the Second World War. The posters everywhere, and well, there was so much of it, the pressures were terrific. So that the people who did go and oppose it had an awful lot to put up with.
And we were forever being threatened with the death sentence over and over again. We'd be marched up somewhere and read out a notice of some man or other being sentenced to death through disobedience at the front. Whether they were true cases or not, I don't know to this day, but it was all done with the idea of intimidating us.
The rush of volunteers had dried up. For the first time in British history, the army forced men to serve. Conscription was introduced from March 1916.
The thing I want to emphasise is the treatment which we were forced to mete out to these poor blighters, because they thought as they did.
To keep the army supplied, if you were a single man aged 18 to 41, not in a job essential to the war effort, and were fit, you were in the army. Unless you could show a conscientious objection.
They stripped a lot of them, you know, when they were arrested and they refused to put on the uniform, just stripped them and left them with nothing and said, now will you put it on? They still refuse, but it's a terrible indignity, and of course they put up with an awful lot from the soldiers and the other members. But here and there, there were people who said, I wish I had the courage to do the same.
I suppose the idea was that, as it was very cold in the evenings and the night, that he would be forced to wear this khaki and to keep himself warm. But he had other ideas. He, during the night, stripped himself of this khaki and carefully shredded the whole of the suit up and hung it around the barbed wire. And that man walked about all night long without a shred of clothing on him. That was the type of treatment which we had to mete out, and I'm bitterly ashamed that I was forced to take part in it.
Thou shalt not kill. Christians, who took the Bible at its word, and Quakers, for whom pacifism was central to their beliefs, objections were most common on grounds of religion. But there were also humanists who felt it wrong to kill, and many on the political left who refused to serve in a war started by the ruling classes that the workers had to fight. Dorothy Byng was brought up in Croydon in a family of pacifists. Her brother Harold was one of the youngest conscientious objectors of the First World War.
Because when the policeman came to arrest him, he had only just that week had his 18th birthday, I think, and the policeman was very worried. He looked so young, he said, are you sure you're 18? Because he didn't want to arrest him at all. He looked such a schoolboy.
The hearing was rather a farce. When my name was called, I appeared before the tribunal. I had my father and one or two other friends there as witnesses to speak on my behalf if necessary.
Harold Byng, who would remain in prison for most of the duration of the war, was among those who experienced the hastily convened tribunals for objectors.
The chairman of the tribunal, after one or two formal questions, asked me how old I was. I said I was 18 years of age. He said, well, in that case, you're not old enough to have a conscience. Case dismissed. My father got up to protest at such summary treatment, but the chairman called, next case, next case, next case. And the clerk explained that there was no next case. I was the last case to be heard that day. And so the chairman and fellow members of the tribunal got up and left the room, leaving my father still protesting.
Tribunals were set up to decide on whether exemptions could be granted. The judging panel, made up of local prominent figures of good standing, along with a uniformed military representative. Men could be entirely exempted, or allowed to avoid a combat role, or were given permission to stay in the UK as long as they continued their work of national importance.
They did grant me a certificate for non-combatant service, which of course I'd explained that I was not prepared to undertake. The military representative almost always opposed the grant of exemption, even if the tribunal were inclined to grant it. Tribunals would often say, well, would you object to our granting this man exemption? And the military representative would say, yes, I don't think there's a case made out.
Dissenting voices were marginalised and the press was very hostile, though later in the war it did begin to ask questions about the treatment of objectors in prison. By the end of the war, 69 had died.
In the cell, well, there was a plank bed which was stood up against the wall during the day, put down at night with a mattress. For the first month, you were not allowed a mattress. You slept on the bare plank boards.
Harold Byng would be in prison from 1916 until the end of the war as a conscientious objector in Kingston Barracks, Wormwood Scrubs and Winchester Prison.
Usually when you go into prison, it becomes monthly that you can write a letter, and you were not allowed to mention anything that happened in prison, favourable or unfavourable, which at the end of 2 years meant that you found it very difficult to fill a letter at all. You were supposed only to discuss domestic matters. And for an unmarried man who'd been in prison for 2 years, it was very few domestic matters one could discuss, and filling the notepaper was quite an art.
We were committed to Mill Hill Barracks, dressed technically forcibly, under protest, shall we say.
Howard Martin was a conscientious objector imprisoned in Rouen, Le Havre and Winchester prisons from 1916 to 1918.
Then we were given 28 days field punishment. Now, field punishment can be a very nasty thing. Prisoners are tied up for 3 nights out of 4, maybe to a fence or to ropes with their arms extended and their feet tied together, and they may be tied back to back. It varies in form. And that's done for 2 hours. Well, it's not exactly a pleasant experience.
And they did that to you, did they?
Yes.
Both the military and the objectors had no precedent to follow. There wasn't a clear policy. Some ended up in jail, others were sent to barracks, and even to France.
Then we were taken under escort to camp at Felixstowe. Of course, all the time we were disobeying orders, it was inevitable. Ah! And from there we were given 28 days imprisonment in an old place called the Harwich Redoubt. It was a very rough old military prison. The only punishments they could doled out then were so many days on bread and water, what they call punishment diet. But I think there was a very definite movement that they would break our resistance by sending us to France. Get us into the firing line, they can pass the death sentence, and that was that.
Another fellow, I well remember, a great big strapping fellow with a large black beard.
Charles Lippitt served as a military policeman in charge of conscientious objectors from 1916 to 1918.
And we had the lousy job of taking this beard off this man. And I should never forget now his eyes as he looked at us, to think that we, men, fellow men, were doing this to him. But we had to do it. I suppose that was our excuse. But ever since then, I've admired those men intensely, because I realised that what they did in defying the British military might, and they defied it in every way possible, they had far more guts than we had who were doing these things to them.
They have great things to get us out there, and I think to set an example. If we can shoot a few of these fellows, that'll put a stop to it. We crossed to Le Havre, and were put in a camp which was industrial work and permanently unfit men, a curious mixture. We were taken out to the parade ground. There was a big concourse of men, mostly of the non-combatant corps and the labour battalions, lined up in an immense square. We were taken to one side of it and then, under escort, taken out one by one to the middle of the square. I was the first of them. And until my verdict was known, nobody knew exactly what was going to happen. That was the real test to the whole business, focused on what the sentence was going to be in my case. An officer in charge of the proceedings read out various crimes and misdemeanors, refusing to obey the lawful command, and disobedience of Boulogne, and all so on and so forth. Then the sentence of the court is to suffer death by being shot. Then there was a suitable pause. And then, the second thing, confirmed by the commander-in-chief. Then another long pause, but subsequently commuted to penal servitude for 10 years. And that was that. And the thing that interested me and the others particularly was that penal servitude meant your return to England and would get us into the hands of the civil authorities to civil prison. You see, as long as we were in the hands of the military authorities, we were subjected to military punishments, and we could only go on offending.
What does it feel like to have a death sentence read out against you?
You had a sort of feeling of being outside yourself. It was very curious, a sort of impersonal feeling, something that wasn't affecting you personally, that you were almost looking on at the proceedings. Very strange.
Well, we had our weekly meetings, which was mostly a get-together to report. Somebody had been arrested and read some of the letters.
The No Conscription Fellowship supported families of objectors and lobbied on their behalf. Both Howard Martin and Dorothy Bing worked for their local branches of the fellowship.
They were some of the most argumentative people, but you found that there were so many different points of view. It seemed inherent among pacifists. They're men of strong individuality, strong differences of opinion.
And then we organised social gatherings from time to time, rambles more often on the Saturday afternoon so that the children could be together with other children, because there was certainly quite a lot of ostracisation. We took them out for rambles in the summer and we had social gatherings at the Society of Friends.
Families were torn apart. Siblings and cousins cut off objectors. Even the children of objectors were ostracised by other members of the community, especially those who'd lost their own sons to the war. The scars could last a lifetime.
And it did have a very bad effect on my mother, I think. You see, she came from a very united family. During my childhood, we were constantly taken to see her sisters and their families. As soon as they realised that Harold wasn't going to fight for his country, they just cut us dead completely. And then after the war was over, it was never healed. They wouldn't have anything to do with us at all.
World War I on the BBC, on TV, radio and online.